Welcome to Game Brain, a podcast about board games and our gaming group. I am Trey Alsop. I am your host for this episode. And today I am joined by the Omni Gamer. She's already smiling, Candace Harris.
Hey, Trey. How's it going?
I'm doing great. I'm very happy to have you here today. We have survived the Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. Seriously, it has been a busy one, but fun. Super fun. So
you had a convention. You had a wedding.
Yeah.
Your voice is a little scratchy.
Yeah, my voice is a little scratchy from yelling through a mask playing Versailles 1919.
And, that is our review for today. Versailles 1919. This is round 13, turn 5. And we're going to talk about the 2020 release of Versailles 1919 for our member segment. That was a pretty smooth transition, wasn't it? Smooth transition. Our member segment, we are going to flip the script. We've talked many times about how to teach a game, and today we are going to explore how to learn a game. And we'll be talking about that based upon Candace's experiences over the last week. Tell me some more about your weekend of weddings and conventions in the era of the Delta variant.
Yeah, so I went to Strategicon, which was held in person for the first time since February of 2020. Strategicon is the local LA convention. It's held at the Hilton Airport right by LAX, and it was kind of crazy. I only went on Saturday, mainly because there's a virtual flea market that happens, right? And I had a ton of games to get rid of.
I did well
because I only sold 10, but I only bought 4. That's the important thing.
Net positive.
Yeah, exactly. I freed up some space, and I got some new goodies to check out. But yeah, it was super weird. The attendance, I mean, as you would expect, you know, with the Delta variant and the COVID still everywhere, was really slim. So it actually made it kind of pleasant. But, you know, you've been to Strategicon before, right, Trey?
I've been at Strategicon since, I think, 1991.
Oh, so. Wow.
It's 3 conventions a year. They each have their own individual names, but it's every kind of like 3-day official 3-day federal holiday weekend.
Right.
They run one of these, and they've been running at different hotels around the airport since the dawn of time. It feels like.
But yeah, usually on a Saturday, like if you go into the open gaming area, you it's hard to find
a table.
Can't find a table, like,
right? Yeah.
Can't find a table, and in this case, you go down in the open gaming area. And, you know, it's about like 25-30% occupied. So, you know, we sat at a table and all of the surrounding tables were empty. So it was just kind of crazy, like almost what I would imagine it would be like going there on a Monday after everybody's all, you
right.
know, super,
sure.
super gamed out. But and they were even letting you do open gaming upstairs where they usually run game 101s and tournaments and everything. So
they could be more lenient about that.
Yes.
Oftentimes, like, yeah, they have to force the open gamers down into the basement, which could be a little cramped and stuffy.
Oh, yeah.
And prioritizing certain events and tournaments. And this time you got to spread out.
Yeah. So it was nice, you know, that I saw a lot of friends there. And a lot of people, you know, didn't stay the whole time. Maybe they just came to sell games at the flea market. But it was still nice to kind of just see some people that I haven't seen in a while and say hi. And I only ended up playing, 3 games there.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Three games in a day these days is highly successful.
Yep. So I played another game of Versailles 1919. And then I also played Meadow with Jennifer. Jennifer was there.
What did you think of Meadow?
So the artwork is gorgeous. I love the watercolor painting on all the cards. I really like the system for drafting the cards. You have these little like fence posts that you put in on a row or column. And depending on the number on it, it says like how far up you can take the card from, you know, which card you're going to take in that row or column. But then there's also on the backside of the fence post you have, and everybody has like five of these, you can put it on this other board and take some other kind of special action. So I thought that was all really super cool. And then there were also the objectives for the game vary because you put out these tiles kind of randomly. So there were a lot of things that were neat about the game, but I thought that I'm not someone who's typically prone to AP, and there was just so much AP because there are so many different icons on these cards. You have some cards in your hand, some in your tableau, and you're trying to like, you know, do what you can to get the most points. But I had so many turns where I'm just sitting there like,
overwhelmed,
just looking. Just overwhelmed. And I thought we played a 3-player game and it was like over 2 hours because of that, you know, because of that AP. So I don't know if, you know, when you look at that game, you expect it to be like an hour, maybe hour and 15 minute kind of game. And maybe it's that way with 2 players, or if you get more experience with it, I'm not sure. But I didn't walk away saying, oh, I need to play this again kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I wondered, do you have certain expectations about a game that's kind of themed that way and looks like that? And then it's longer that doesn't seem to align. I mean, I certainly remember the days where a game you could play in 2 hours would have been considered a fast game. And our standards have changed that way. But Jennifer, we did, I think a lot of the Game Rainers, we opted out of Strategicon this year and just decided to kind of have a little private game con at Tom's office this weekend starting Friday night. You were there for Friday night, and we had a friend in from out of town, Mark Now. And so we had our own little brain con just there in Tom's office that I think was pretty successful, but just to kind of like avoid some of the difficulty of going to a con. Like I'm ready. I'm still going to try to go to BGG con in November. Cool. Like that's the plan, but it's still like, I'm still a little worried.
Skeptical.
You know, like, is that going to be fun? Like, I'm sure we can do it. And it sounded like everybody was pretty safe at the convention. But like, was it still fun, like gaming in a mask and being around other people, or was it?
It was still fun, being in the environment of all these people playing games. You know, even with masks on, and you know, I have glasses, so I occasionally have that issue where they fog up.
Sure.
And you know, by the time I left on Saturday, I was wearing a new mask, and it was kind of digging into my throat, like my neck on my throat a little bit, and I was like, oh. You know, so it's not like the most ideal situation, but I'd rather be cautious, you know. And it's, you know, I like going to game conventions. But I was bummed that I missed more of the BrainCon because of the wedding and everything. It sounded like, I'm assuming you guys had a blast.
Well, let's talk. Let's fold this into. And discuss what we played this weekend. Okay, you've already covered Meadow. Was Meadow? That's the name of the game, right?
Yes, Meadow. Yes,
I've seen the art. It looks great. I am eager to check it out. But let's talk about BrainCon a little. You know, at Tom's office, a little unofficial game BrainCon. You brought out a game that I immediately fell in love with. Scout. Tell us about Scout.
Yeah, Scout is this awesome little, I guess, ladder climbing game where you have this deck of cards that has each card has two numbers on it, one in the upper left corner and one in the bottom right corner. And there's a whole mechanic where you are able to flip these cards when you first get them. So you can, you know, when you fan out your hand, you're going to say, do I want to keep them in this position or do I want to flip my entire hand to the other side? And what you're doing, and it's also a game where when you are, everybody's going to get dealt the same amount of cards, you deal the whole deck out. And you cannot rearrange the cards in your hand. So it's kind of like Bonanza, or if anyone's played Kraskariart, which is now being called Delt, the US version. Mm-hmm. You can't rearrange the cards in your hand. And you have three actions you can take. One is play, one is scout, and then a once per round, you can do a scout and play together. And when you play, you just have to play a higher combo than what's already on the table as the prior highest combo. And combos are either like a single card, a higher single card beats that, and then a two-card run would beat that. And then a higher two-card run would be a lower two-card run kind of thing. And then two of a kind beats a two-card run, and so on and so forth. And you can play as many cards as you want in this these type of combos.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is when you play a when you take the play action and you beat somebody else's hand that was previously face up on the table, you take that card face down. That's going to be a point for you. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, if you scout, let's say that Trey plays a beefy turn where he's able to play like four sevens. You know, that's kind of hard to beat. So you might have to scout. And scouting lets you take one of the cards on either side of Trey's four sevens. But the cool thing is, Trey gets a point for that. They're point mm-hmm. tokens. But the cool thing is, when you take one of the cards on the end, you get to put it in your hand wherever you want and orient it however you want. So if one of the cards was a seven with a four on the bottom, you could take that card and you could insert it anywhere in your hand as a four or as a seven. So you can kind of set up these beefy turns for yourself and really cool combos. And then there's the scout and play where you can scout from someone, take a card, but then you immediately play and beat it. And I mean, the timing of using that is often really important, because sometimes you'll do it thinking, you know, it just makes sense. But then later you'll be regretting like, oh, I wish I had my scout and play right now so I could go out or something. So there's this like really cool hand management and lots of really neat decisions when you scout, because you don't only scout, you don't have to scout when you have to scout. You can also scout because you want to set something.
To create the super hand, the upcoming super hand. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm glad you liked it. Yeah.
To me, this game felt like individual teach you. Like teach you that didn't require pairs, but you're doing kind of a similar, like, here's my situation. What can I do? Like you're going to make certain plays to hopefully set up some bigger plays later on. And it does have a similar dynamic of like trying to dump your hand, like trying to get out is a central thing. Yes. You're trying to score points in the process of doing that. But generally like getting out first is going to feel like it's going to probably be a win for at least for that round. You're going to do very well if you're first out, I think, in that game. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah.
I didn't mention, Trey, sorry to cut you off there. But yeah, I totally forgot to mention, yeah, when you're scoring at the end of the round, any cards left in your hand are negative 1 point each per card. So yeah,
you're highly incentivized to
get rid of your cards.
You're definitely going to have crummy hands. This is going to be played over a series of rounds the way they teach you is. Maybe but much shorter, like compressed compared to a teach you round. Also, so like there's going to be times where you just kind of like have a bad hand. It's going to be hard for you to make something out of it. And then there's other times where like you have a good hand and you like really want to maximize it, run up the score. And so, you know, over time, you're going to be kind of winning or losing over, you know, maximizing your successes, minimizing your losses. But if you like teach you, I think this is going to appeal to a lot of the same people. And it certainly appealed to me. I tend to like games that I do well in, and I won our game on Friday night. So that's probably why I'm giving it the glowing review. But this could be the new hotness on little card games, I think.
Yeah, totally. And I'll note that you won, but remember, I wasn't playing.
That's true.
I was teaching and dealing. So
this is not an indication that I beat Candace in any way, only that I did beat Tom.
The other thing is, right now, I don't believe you can get this game anywhere in the U.S. Like, I had to order my copy on Amazon.jp because I think the publisher is a Japanese publisher.
Is that right?
Yeah, I believe so. But anyway, I know it's starting to get some popularity, so hopefully we'll see.
It'll get here. It's just a question of when. Yeah. So this is Scout with an exclamation point if you're trying to find it out there. All right, let's run through real quick some of the other games we played. Obviously, we played some Versailles 1919 on Friday night. You played it again at the con with our mutual friend Steve Inebri, correct?
Yes.
Okay. We also, on Friday night, I think we had a game of Age of Steam. Then once BrainCon got going on Saturday, we got in a really great game of Panamax. The more I play that game, the more I want to play that game. Like, I
haven't played
this
it.
This is a top 20 game for me.
Ugh, you got to teach it to me sometime.
I'm happy to do so. We got in a game of Dune Imperium. It's a game I'm still not loving, but the Canonax loved it.
I love it. I love,
love
Dune Imperium.
You love I'm it. I'm, often, I'm frustrated by that game very often. Concordia, we played Saturday night. It was good. We got in a game of Babylonia. We also, we're still flirting with Quest. Like, in our great quest to find a replacement for Avalon, we continue to play Quest. We actually had our best game of Quest so far in terms of, like, it worked out that it, like, did the things that we wanted it to do. And, like, prior to this match, I think we had, we're probably at about, like, 10 plays, but it had felt like the good guys had won 9 times and the bad guys only once. And so, like, is that imbalanced or do we just not know what we're doing? But we had a bad guy win and it felt like what we wanted the game to be like. So maybe we're learning it properly. It doesn't feel exactly like Avalon, which is good. Like, we're having to craft a new meta, and like some of the things that I think are like observations that we apply to Avalon don't apply to Quest, and so that's making it interesting. So we're still figuring out if Quest is worth everyone's time. But maybe if we're wrestling with it this much, that's probably a good sign.
Yeah,
it's not an instant win. We love it, but it's still kind of. But it is capturing. It is a game on the brain, I guess.
Yeah.
And finally, on Sunday we got in games of Agricola and Anno 1800.
Nice.
Which is a very good game, but continues to frustrate me. I feel like as beautiful as that game is, and it has kind of like as good looking as so much of it is, I feel like they released this game too soon or something. I feel like it needed another playtest just on the cards. Like the cards that you are dealt at the beginning are not created equal
at
all. And so I'm wondering, like, does it need, like, the way that people play Agricola now when you play it competitively is you draft. And I'm like wondering, does Anno need a draft in order to kind of like filter out certain things or let you build combos? Have you played Anno 1800?
I have only played it once, and it's really funny. It's one of these games where I walked away and I was like, oh, that was okay. That was cool. But then later that night, I played that with Jennifer actually. Later that night, I just started kind of thinking about it. And then I start like watching some videos on it, and it really got in my head, and I ended up pre-ordering it. So I've been excited to try it again. But yeah, it's kind of strange because like when I was actually playing the game, I wasn't that wowed. But then it resonated with me after the fact, which is cool. You know,
yeah.
I feel like that often happens with some of my favorite bands that I listen to. I didn't immediately say, this is amazing. You know, I was like, there's something going on there. And then I listened more. So I don't have a strong opinion. Like, I need to play it more, but I do want to play it more. And Yeah.
So yeah, like maybe not surprisingly, given who I am, I was frustrated by some of the more random elements in the game. There's a lot of kind of draws, both in terms of the cards you get. Some of it are like drawing new world tiles or old world tiles. And there are some that are just flat out better than others. And some of it's just situational, but it just, yeah, a lot of it just feels like these are random draws that can be good, bad.
Gotcha.
And like that always frustrates me rather than, hey, here's the situation, now make some choices.
Right.
That kind of randomness doesn't bother me when it's just good or bad for you on a card draw. That tends to make my head explode a little bit.
I get that. Yeah.
All right, let's get to the news.
Good evening, Mr. Mission Office, South America, and all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to France. News.
First up, Lacerda's Weather Machine is coming to Kickstarter on October 28th, 2021. You can check this out on Board Game Geek. Have you had a chance to look at this game yet, Candace?
I have just looked at it, but I haven't played it yet. I am trying to hopefully play it at some point before the Kickstarter launch. From the sounds of it and the looks of it,
behind the scenes to be able to play it ahead of time.
Yeah, I was for when Vital's game Mercado de Lisboa came out. I was part of. I joined a contest and I did a play test for it and I covered it in BGG News.
Right.
So I'm on his server where people are playtesting. So I can certainly jump in a game. And it's kind of been one of those things that's on my list, but I've just been so busy lately that I haven't gotten a chance to check it out. But I've read about it. I've, you know, seen lots of pictures and it sounds really cool.
Anything Lacerda is definitely like an instant back for our group. That said, this theme initially does not excite me that much. I'm like, my fear with this theme is that it's like a Trismegistus type of thing,
which
is just that it's kind of a wacky make-em-up rather than it having like an actual narrative thread that's going to engage me.
Yeah.
Here. Like that's just my little one concern, but I'm still like certain I'm going to play it as soon as it comes up.
Yeah.
Mixlore Games has announced a board game based upon the hit Netflix series The Queen's Gambit. The game is called let me check here. The game is called Chess. No, actually the game is called The Queen's Gambit Das Damengambit. I'm sorry. I stole that joke from someone else. terrible anyway. I'm looking at this game. It actually is interesting because it's a game where you're programming your moves out in advance. You're playing like cards to move this kind of central gambit token that then kind of hoovers up various pieces. So it's still an abstract strategy, but it can play four players on a chessboard.
Yeah.
So
I love abstract strategy games. And
did you watch The Queen's Gambit?
Yes. And when I say watched, let's see, Matt, my significant other, he was watching it and I was kind of in and out. So I saw most of it and I really loved what I saw. But don't quiz me on every episode.
Right. On the actual order of things.
Yeah.
In other news, Alexander Nevsky, the designer of Mysterium, has announced a new game called Settlement. I'm looking at a picture of it here. It looks very worker placement-y or something that I would like. I think in this game, you are the leader of settlers who have discovered new lands using powerful artifacts. You will explore terrains, hunt monsters, construct buildings, and create outposts. I like Mysterium. Like that's a game that feels very different than some other games. So I'm eager to check out Settlement. Looks like it's trying to be somewhat in like a little fantasy realm so that they're not, this is not a, like a real, it's not a world historical settlement thing.
Right.
Thinking.
Yeah. I'm curious to check it out. I, you know, Mysterium was pretty much my gateway game into the hobby. So it's always going to have a soft.
Mysterium is part of your origin story.
Yeah.
As a superhero gamer. All right, Geek Attitude Games is working with Espressman to release Brussels 1897, a card game that is based upon the earlier Brussels 1893, which I'm a big fan of. And this is going to include an expansion to Brussels 1893 called Belle Epoque. And so I think, let's see, I'm not sure this will be a Kickstarter, and it will be released in hopefully 2022, maybe 2023.
Yeah.
Given the current issues with games coming over from China at this time. Just so people know, though, you can play Brussels 1893 right now online at watija.net. I didn't know about this, but Ben pointed this out, and we've played a couple of games on Watija, which is another platform like Board Game Arena where you can play games online. And that's a very solid game. I don't know if you've played it.
No, I have not played. When I went to Essen in 2019, I did check out a demo of Brussels 1897.
That's kind of like a simpler card game version.
I think so. And I thought it was going to be one that I was going to kind of take home, but I was like, oh, this is cool. But, you know, I passed on it. You know, you only have so much suitcase space. So it didn't make it home.
There's a big issue
when
you go to Essen, yes, is take the empty suitcase.
Yep, exactly.
On the front end. Okay,
but finally, I've heard great things about Brussels 1893.
It's solid, and also very pretty, done in that what is it, deco art style? That we associate with that, or am I confusing my art?
Let's go with art.
Okay. In final news, Infinity Pi Games has announced that World Cup is a re-implementation of the World Cup game will go on Kickstarter on November 1st. So the World Cup game has been around for over a decade, and we've played it with our group pretty much every time there's been a World Cup. I think like we've covered two of the last three World Cups, we have played the World Cup game. And so this is going to be a re-release. And I think so I'm eager to play that, especially because I'm really looking forward to the current World Cup, even though the United States qualifying run so far has been really embarrassingly dismal.
Yeah.
Very disappointed in Team USA right now, but we're still going to make it. I'm hoping we're still going to make the tournament. We're supposed to be the 10th best team in the world, right? But one of the interesting things about this game is I think they are going to do once the actual final teams, like once we get through qualifying, which is happening right now over the course of like the next 6 months, they will actually release this game with all of the proper teams that are in the 2022 World Cup.
Oh, nice.
So I'm assuming we're definitely getting this, and we'll be playing this at the appropriate time.
That's cool. I've never heard of it actually, but I'm a sucker for games with more unique and more rare themes.
The thing that might make this very different than other games we've played is that what you're doing in the game is you're managing the tournament. World Cup has its own kind of like weird structure where you have like a group stage, and then, teams emerge out of that group stage, and then there's a single elimination tournament to determine the winner. And so the game is actually played of like managing this single elimination tournament. And you, at the beginning, if I remember correctly, you're often kind of like you're not wagering, but you're kind of putting your assets behind certain teams. So certain teams that are historically strong, like Brazil and Germany, you can back them, but you're kind of like competing to do that. And like, it actually makes sense for you to back a certain number of long shots in certain ways that you can still get returns on. So it isn't simply a matter of like, I'm going to pick Brazil, I win. you actually do, there are reasons to kind of like invest in all the different teams at various levels. It's like, are you getting priced right for doing that? And then you play the game and you're able to kind of like manipulate the tournament in some ways. Like, do you decide to spend your resources to, make sure that Spain gets past Portugal here in this, quarterfinal match? Because if they get past them, they're going to face Czechoslovakia, and then that's an easy road to the semis, or something like that. But I think you're spending your resources then to like manipulate the tournament. And it's still all, despite all that, it played pretty quickly for a big tournament like it. Anyway, looking Sounds forward awesome. To it. Did my excitement come through for the yes. for the yes. game?
I'm excited about it now too. So yes, good job.
All right, let's talk about the games that are on our brains.
Games of the brain. These are games we like to play. These are games stuck on our brains, oh baby.
Candace, what's on your brain?
Oh man, Trey. So, I mean, I recently, about 2 weeks ago at this point, I guess, got to attend an awesome private gaming convention that was 10 days long. 10 Whoa. Days of gaming. And I played a lot of games. I played a lot of the classics, a lot of classics for the first time, such as Tigris and Euphrates.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. I played Goa. I played St. Petersburg, Macau, Merchant of Venus.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, all sorts of old school games. And I played Civilization, A New Dawn, Sid Meier's Civilization, A New Dawn with the expansion. And I really enjoyed that to the point where I had the base game and it's been on my for sale list. I had never played it before.
Uh-huh.
But I was just like, you know, something is not getting me excited enough to get it to the table. But then I played it with the expansion and I went up to my room that night and ordered the expansion in addition to like an Etsy insert. Like I went all in.
Gotcha.
So that was really cool. I checked out, I played the new version of The Crew, which is really, really good. If you're a fan of The Crew.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. So playing all of these quote unquote older games, mm-hmm. like, was that what you set out to be your mission? Or is that just kind of like how it worked out? Like how did that come about that this was the block of games that you played?
Yeah, no, it was not my mission at all. It was that I was meeting a lot of new people and, you know, I don't know the first one was Tigris and Euphrates. And it was just like, wait, you've never played that? We have to show you that. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of people that were like super cool and kind of invested in, you know, having me check out these games, which I thought was really cool because they were just as, you know, I'm excited to always like play new or, you know, I put air quotes around new, but any games that I haven't tried, I'm always like really interested and curious to try them, but they were equally as excited to show them to me, which I thought was really cool. Yeah. So I think it was, you know, something just came up and it was just like, what? You've never played XYZ?
Right.
Well, we have to fix that, you know? So that's how, and then, yeah. And then it kind of snowballed into like different people realizing like, oh, wait, you haven't played Princess of Florence? We have to show you Princess of Florence. And it was really cool. So I actually did not even play as many newer games as mm-hmm. I would have expected. Then I also played, an older Jason Matthews, who's one of the designers of Twilight Struggle. Played Founding Fathers. That was pretty cool. And, you know, reminded me a little bit of Versailles 1919, which we'll get into in a bit.
I'm now holding up my copy of Founding Fathers,
which
I still have not played. But I'm always interested in historical games, especially because I was designing a President Washington game, and so I checked this out. You liked this?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
I did, and I kind of because I'm trying to not overload my collection. I'm like, is this something I want to buy?
Well, now you know someone who has the game, so
yeah. So that's good to know. Played Steffenfeld's Oracle, the Oracle of Delphi, for the first time.
Never played that. Okay.
I now own it because,
okay.
You know, it's at this point out of print because it was published by Tasty Minstrel Games. So I went on the BGG market and was able to find a copy of that. So I'm happy to teach that. I thought it was really cool. It's a more medium complex kind of racing game where you have these boats, this variable board set up, and you're racing around with your boats to try to complete your objectives. faster than your opponents. And you're like, you know, there's some like you're picking up cube and it needs to be delivered to this place. And then like you're fighting monsters, which we were joking. We're like, all right, this is a failed dungeon crawler. But the way you take your actions is driven by dice. You roll these three dice,
right,
and you put them on your player board wherever they are. There's a color and a corresponding symbol if you're colorblind. And then you're like the actions you take are based on the colored dice that you have because everything is kind of like color symbol based. But you can spend these favor tokens to kind of change. Like, oh, maybe I don't need a red, but I needed a black, so I could spend two favor tokens to convert it. So it was really neat. So
what year would this game have been?
2016. Oh, okay. Good. I'm just going off memory. So that was.
It seems like Stefan Feld has been like trying to figure out like how to make dice work.
Yeah.
In the last like 5 years or so,
mm-hmm.
because I feel
mm-hmm.
like he was almost like took on the challenge of people saying like roll to move. That's a horrible mechanism, and mm-hmm. he said, well, I'll make Merlin. You know, to try to like see roll to move can work. And I wonder if Oracle of Delphi is also kind of like experimenting with dice and like making dice work in a way that's different than just, you know, like the Risk style or
succeed
or fail or did you, you know.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's also one of the things I loved about it is that when you when you're finished your turn, you always roll the three dice, and then all the other players can get some benefit. Like there are these like god tracks that you can bump up on based on the color that of the dice that I rolled. So everybody gets this like cool benefit, and then while other people are taking their turns, I can decide like what am I doing with my dice on my next turn. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's just something that like really resonated with me about that one.
Great.
And then I also, at this convention I brought a prototype of my game. And I got to run four games of that and, you know, getting feedback and iterating in between, as best as possible.
Tell us about, what is your game called?
Oh yeah. So I'm designing a game right now called Stage Left, and it is a game in which, players are building their own rock bands in a city where there's barely any music scene. And you're building the music scene based on different genres you're playing with. Like right now we're just playtesting with heavy metal, punk, and alternative. So mm-hmm. there's like a stock market track where you are trying to increase the value of fan cubes. So you have fan cubes that you get when you go to play gigs. And, you know, at the beginning of the game, because there's no music scene, each fan cube is just worth one fame point, which is a victory point.
Uh-huh.
But as you do things in the game, get different types of songs on the radio, play gigs, you're going to boost the value of these different genres and make each of your fan cubes that you've collected worth more fame for end game scoring.
So you're building an audience, not just for your band, but for like an entire like genre of music.
Yes.
Like you're creating heavy metal fans. Is that, am I reading that right?
Yeah. You're getting there. You know, these cubes are kind of seeded out into the different venues. And there's a certain amount of them depending on number one, the activity that the players are driving. You know, if heavy metal keeps getting pushed, it's going to kind of create more heavy metal fans. But the more heavy metal pushes, number one, the other two genres are kind of, there's like a catch-up mechanic where they're going to start gradually building up to kind of catch up because you're building the music scene for one genre, but it's also just, you know, as a result, building it for other genres.
Mm-hmm.
But the value of the, like, let's say everybody decided to be heavy metal and you're like kind of oversaturating the music scene with heavy metal,
the
value of the cubes is going to gradually decrease. So it's kind of a tightrope of
it's balancing. A music market game.
Yes.
It sounds.
And
if
then
the, if people don't know, Candace, you are a musician.
Yes. I am a musician, primarily a drummer, but I also can play guitar and a couple other things.
And you have been in bands. Have you been on the road?
I, you know, only slightly on the road, you know, some little mini tours here and there, but and that's exactly why I wanted to create this game. Initially, the game was like kind of like you're touring the U.S. And I was like, well, that's not my experience that I've had. Uh-huh. So I wanted it to kind of be, you know, where what I know of, like, hey, one of my first bands were when I lived in Philly. And it's like, you know, we're just trying to be like the best band in Philly. So, yeah. And the one of the core mechanisms is deck building. So you are deck building song cards, which are going to help you get fan cubes when you play gigs. And then you're also getting these five different types of skill cards that are like production gear, stage presence, songwriting, different elements you need for to put on a show.
Yeah.
So you have these two different types of cards that you're going to be building in your deck. And then on your player board, you have little musician cards, and they give you special powers and they influence what your band genre is. And then there are also these popularity tracks. So you can work your way up the virtuoso track, the viral video track, or the record deal track along the way, which is why some people were, after I ran the game the first time with four, you know, new players, they were getting kind of Zulkin vibes from it. Because of the way the tracks kind of integrate with the rest of the gameplay.
Right.
Well,
tell me about like how you play tested this four times.
Four times.
How did that process go? What did you take away from these play tests? And like, were you play testing with some other designers also, or what was your odd? Who were you playing with?
Yeah. So, the people that attended the convention. There were a lot of game designers there that are, you know, more established game designers or publishers there. And there are just people who love playing games and play a lot of games. So I've kind of had different combinations in throughout the four games I played. And three of them I had game designers, which was, you know, every bit of feedback is important and helpful. But game designers definitely can give you feedback in a different way because they're used to designing games, and especially ones that are way more experienced than me, could really like give me some very helpful feedback. So, you know, I play a game, survey, see what people thought. In I think all cases, like people were really digging it, and you know, it was very positive response, which I was kind of excited about. And, but they would give me some notes like, oh, like maybe this is overpowered, or, and it would also be things I observed like, hey, there's too much downtime because I'm giving people the decision of this and this, you know? So what I would do is go up to the hotel room, use my little Sharpie and adjust like either cards. Oh yeah, like one of the playtests, I discovered like something was too expensive. Certain cards were too expensive, sure. So I just kind of like changed it. Then I take it back down the next day, run it again, get different feedback from a completely different audience, and like take all that feedback, and then you know do the same thing. It was on the third game that I played, where I had some people or one of the designer who was playing. Was kind of questioning my action selection that I had, because you would have this meeple that you, when you decide what action you're going to take, you move to a different location. Like you go to a rehearsal studio to do three different actions. You can go to the radio station to do a couple actions, or the music shop, and you're kind of bouncing around, or the venues to play a gig. And I started thinking, because I'm trying to streamline things, so I was like, hey, like what if I just get rid of that action selection and just let people kind
do what
of
they want.
Choose an action. Yeah, choose an action and do it. And then somebody suggested, well, what if you made it a rondel? And I thought about it and I was like, I have to try this. And it made so then I had Matt help me update my prototype. Sure. And I built out this rondel. I thought about the order in which the actions would go in, and Trey, I'm telling you, I went from the game was taking 2 hours and 45 minutes to 3 hours to play, to the fourth game with the rondel took an hour and 45 minutes. Great. And I will note that on the fourth game I was playing, so there was one less new player, and also one of the game designers who was playing is notorious for like playing really fast. But I also think just the switching from the action selection that I had to the rondel made things go faster because it kind of limits your options of what you're going to do next. Instead of looking at, oh, I'm going to move,
we were talking about that earlier. It's like, sometimes like you just have too many choices and that's overwhelming as opposed to like, I can do one of these three things. What is the best thing for me to do now? Or do I need to do this thing before I do that other thing? Like, that's about the level of decision space you probably want. So a question for you. So before you went to the rondel, was it the kind of thing where like, okay, we have a rehearsal studio space, and if one player is in that, did it prohibit other bands from rehearsing?
No. So the way it worked is if somebody or if any other players were there and you move there to take an action, they get to draw a card and discard. So they get a little passive benefit from being there before other players, but it's not like a worker placement where you are blocking people out. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Like those are almost opposite things in concepts of like whether you get rewarded or like whether you're blocking and that's negative or you get rewarded for getting bumped because what a gallerist is kind of like you're choosing these actions that you're not actually blocking anybody. But when you get bumped, like you get a nice little mini reward.
Right.
But the rondel is just going to kind of like just get rid of that and
and
it's helping just players focus their decisions is what
exactly. And you know, even with the rondel, like I'm not limiting how so you can move three spaces for free and you pay. So the action points are energy in my game. So you spend energy to take different actions. So you spend three, or you can move three spaces for free. But anything beyond that, you just have to spend extra energy.
Right.
So, you know, so if you want to play back-to-back gigs, go for it. But it's going to be costly with your action points, you know?
That sounds like other rondel games you've played. Yeah. Like, especially like early, like playing Imperial. It's a rondel game. And at the end of the game, like spending that energy, as you said, like spending what resources you have in order to do exactly what you want makes sense. And the danger in that game, at least, is like at the end, everybody's doing the same thing because there's like right moves to close out the game. But But I do like that. I also it seems right that your game, like the core resource would be energy.
Mm-hmm,
like just keeping the band going, keeping the band together, like that requires energy.
Yes. And you know, it's come a long way, I'll tell you, because before I had time and money were resources and it was like, oh, some things. And I also have street cred in the game too, which is kind of like, I like to tell people it's like having ribbons in Great Western Trail kind of thing. But so I had like time, I had money, and you do this, you need to spend time. And it was just like too much. Yeah. So eventually it just changed to energy. But yeah, I just got such really helpful feedback. Because when I was more actively playtesting the game before this, I was kind of doing it once a week, once every couple weeks, and also with the same group of like probably 10 friends of mine that I rotate between playtesting my game, which I want to get you to play it too.
I would love to play it.
But yeah, but it was really cool. I'm really excited about it. And also the rondel, which my friend Jake already helped me with, is looks like a vinyl record. And it's really cool.
You showed me a photo of that. That does look fantastic. It does fit a game, especially because like it places your game that places it in a certain time period. Like that's not a 2021 band if it's got a vinyl record.
2021 vinyl is very popular.
Well, I guess it's back. Yeah.
I have a vinyl collection now.
I stand corrected.
Yeah, and I'm not sure yet if there's going to be kind of a period attached to the game or if it's, you know, more let the players interpret it however they want, you know.
Uh-huh.
But yes, vinyl is back, and I'm not making it a CD.
Well, they're gone too, pretty much. So, yeah, right. How do you have your digital download?
Well, I did an 8-track. an 8-track like tape thing.
I'm sure half of our viewers don't even know what an 8-track, our listeners don't even know what an 8-track is. I don't know. Hopefully we're not all that old, but yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
My dad had it all.
All right, well, are you ready to get to our review? What a smooth transition from a rock and roll band game to the Treaty of Versailles. The end of the negotiations to end World War I, the Great War, and establish the League of Nations. Yes, that's right. We are talking about
great transition.
smooth, Trey. We are talking about the game Versailles, 1919. This was released in 2020. The designers of this game are Mark Herman and Jeff Ingelstein. We should probably know both of these guys. Jeff Ingelstein has designed 22 games, including Space Cadets, Super Skill Pinball, and a lot of us also know him as one of the former hosts of Ludology, which was a great series that everyone should go back and listen to on their podcasts to learn more about game design. And then we also have Mark Herman, who is a real like GMT core designer for GMT and has done games like Fire in the Lake, Churchill, Washington's War, and Pericles. The artists for this game are Donal Hegarty and Roger McGowan. And again, this is from GMT Games. So Candace, tell us how do we play Versailles 1919?
All right, Trey. And it's worth mentioning also that Versailles is the third game in GMT's Great Statesman series, you know, along with Churchill, I think was the first, then Pericles. And now there are two other games that are in, I think, P500 right now, queued up for development in this series. But in Versailles 1919, so it's a 1-4 player game, and we are taking on the role of the big four, I guess, Woodrow Wilson for the U.S., David Lloyd George for the United Kingdom, Vittorio Orlando from Italy, and President George Clemenceau from France, and we are pretty much negotiating at the end of World War I, trying to get the Versailles Treaty out there. So over the course of the game, you're going to kind of be using your influence, which is these small wooden cubes, to settle issues that are aligned with your agenda. And as various issues become settled, information is kind of leaking out through newspapers and rumors. And as that kind of circulates, it causes unrest in different regions of the world, which is tracked on the game board. And as that unrest develops, the issues that you settle can become unsettled. So if you're looking at the game board is laid out really well for Versailles 1919. On the left side of the board, you have the conference room where you can see which issues are currently on the table. And then there's always an event on the table. And issues are cards. So there are large cards that have multiple rows. I think it's about 2 to 4 rows of ways that the issue could be resolved when someone actually resolves it. But then you also have, so you have two issues on the table that you're currently like discussing and negotiating, but you have three issues that are in the waiting room that are going to be, you know, potentially coming down as future issues to be settled. And then you also have some event cards. On the right side of the board, you have this area where you have a grid that shows you other regions and how they're responding to the issues that we're settling in Versailles. And there is a token to track how much unrest is being created in different regions, such as Europe, Africa, the Pacific, Middle East. And then you can also on that track kind of add your military, deploy your military into those regions. And you have some influence on the unrest to either potentially prevent an uprising, or maybe you want an uprising for some reason. But if you deploy your military out there, you can influence that. Then on the bottom of the game board, there's a track that's keeping track of your nation's, all the various nations in the game, happiness, right, including Japan, which is a non-player. But there's a track that goes from 0 to 25, and you're keeping track of each nation's happiness. And depending on how these different issues get resolved, the it's going to impact different nations' happiness in addition to creating unrest.
Yeah, like with the ideas, like if a certain nation's happiness drops below a certain point, they would probably like not sign the treaty. At
right.
This is certainly the case of Italy and Japan. But yeah, this is kind of like to just reflects like how are these various nations viewing, how's it going, you know,
right,
with the whole, right, with the whole conflict. And this is a very important metric that you're tracking throughout the game.
Yeah. And I mean, overall, the actions you take in the game are very, very straightforward. On your turn, you always have to do exactly one political action, and then you may do a military action. And it's all summarized. There's a handy player aid card that has everything you pretty much need to know after you learn the game. But for your political action, one of the main things you'll do is you're going to place influence out on these issues. And when I say place influence, I mean you're putting cubes out on a card. And when you do this, you have to put it on exactly two issues. They could be in the waiting room, one of the three cards in the waiting room, or one of the two on the table. And you have to, when you take that particular action, you have to be winning, meaning you have a majority of influence cubes out on that card to do this. The other thing you could do is settle an issue, which is taking one of the two issues that's on the table and resolving it. And the person who has the most cubes on it, which doesn't have to be you, the person who's settling it, will get that card and choose one of those options for how that issue is settled. And then the person who kind of settles it's also the main source of victory points is on these issue cards. So I think they range, what do you think, from like 3 to 7 points each?
I think that's the range, yep.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
So
you definitely want to be settling issues in this game. But depending on how many issues you have settled for a certain region, and if an uprising happens, you might lose some of those at some point. And then there's a bid to gain control and resettle those issues. The other thing you're going to be doing is, like, throughout the game, as you settle issues and you put cubes out onto different issue cards, they're going to become exhausted. So one of your actions, your political actions, is just reclaiming your cubes and military that have been exhausted. And then for your military action, which is optional, you can deploy, and you have three. You start the game with three discs, which are your armies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you can deploy them out on spaces on the region track, one of the region tracks. And again, it'll help you not only with bidding if there's an uprising and there's an event that or a issue that gets unsettled, but it'll also help you have some kind of manipulation over whether or not an uprising is going to occur. But yeah, that's pretty much like what you're doing in the game. You're going to be bidding on these issues, you know, putting your influence out there, trying to gain as many as you can, while also just managing whether or not uprisings happen with your military. When the first uprising, successful uprising happens, you're going to draft strategy cards, which are going to help guide your strategy for the rest of the game and give you other ways to score points.
Right. These strategy cards kind of say you're pursuing this particular strategy and you're going to be rewarded for accumulating basically like these certain outcomes that the various issues are going to generate. And this, right. And you kind of do it in reverse order. So like whoever's doing worst at this initial, you know, first around the post, you know, first turn of the game, like whoever's trailing a little bit, like you're going to get first pick of what issues are going to be important to you. And then in reverse order, you kind of pick these strategy cards, right?
Yep, yep. And it's also worth mentioning that this is a negotiation game. Yes. So everything, just about everything is negotiable, and you can negotiate with your cubes because, you know, as you start putting your influence cubes out on the cards, the issues that are on the game board, you're running out of them. And, you know, as certain ones become exhausted, you run out of them. So you can, you know, negotiate different outcomes of scenarios.
You actually have like this influence currency that
yes.
you can trade with. So it's a negotiation game, not just in the sense of like, I'm threatening you or I'm making deals with you in which we're going to trade A for B. We literally have like an influence currency that where we can kind of sweeten certain deals. And often that's exactly mm-hmm. what we're negotiating on is, you know, is this, you know, can I get two influence out of Candace for me to kind of like do her this minor favor? Or is she only going to get one? Is that
right.
not enough? But it's nice to actually have like a currency that one can swap, because I think this is one of the strengths of the game is this kind of like influence mechanic.
Yeah.
Right. And so it helped me to think of them as like, this is my little team of ambassadors. And each of these issues is an auction. You know, I have a finite number of ambassadors. I have a finite amount of like energy, almost kind of like mm-hmm. use your game. And it's just like, what am I going to devote my energy to? What am I going to devote my ambassadors to? And that's finite. And once I've spent them, they're gone and I have to rest to get them back. So it's always a question of like, where am I going to, you know, spend my energy or spend my ambassadors. And even then there's times where you devote a lot of ambassadors to an issue and you still get outbid and
yeah.
you feel like, oh, this was a real waste of some of my time. Now you're able to recapture some of that energy when you lose, but you also, you feel like, oh, there was missed opportunities. This was a bad use of my turn.
Right.
I really should never have gotten involved in the Balkans.
Yeah, but one of the things you can do to kind of mitigate that is if you are the one that chooses to settle an issue and you're not winning it. So like, let's say Trey has more cubes on an issue than I do, but I really want my cubes back. I could choose to settle that issue, even though Trey's going to get that card and get those points, but I would get all of my influence back and all of his as being the one who won the issue card goes to the exhausted pool. And that's when I could also say, hey, Trey, I'll give you two influence cubes or ambassadors, two of my ambassadors, if you settle this issue like this. Like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I'm playing as Italy and one of your options is to like make Italy's happiness go down three. I don't want that to happen. So I'd say, hey, would you take two cubes to pick a different option? You know, so that's some of the negotiation that comes into play. The other thing, like,
of like, I think what was the appeal of the game to me.
Yeah.
Was, you know, you're not going into this game and like, I'm going to ally with Candace. Like, that's not really how it works. But you do form a lot of like mini alliances or temporary alliances over certain issues, or like it seems like the more of these like little mini alliances you can make, the better you're going to do, right? Like,
yes.
you can be rewarded for not being a jerk in this game, right?
Yeah.
And I think especially with our group, if a game that's going to enable kind of like meaningful social negotiation, that's a game that we're going to gravitate towards.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of the game. And it's like some games I've played of this, you know, it's not like the negotiation aspect is happening every turn.
Right.
And some games it happens more than not. Like our game Friday night, I feel like, you know, we were two turns in and already there were some wheeling and dealing being going on. And I think it's really interesting and fun and engaging. But other games, it's like not as much sometimes I've noticed.
Yeah, some of it could probably be, you know, who's playing. And I also suspect that the more we start to master the systems of the game, the more we will understand when we should be negotiating, what we should be negotiating for. Certainly when you first start playing this game, you're pulling a lot of levers And I think like we're still experimenting with, you know, like when we should pull certain levers and to what effect. Like, I think we were having a number of discussions with our friend Mike Kananak about like, do you want unrest to go up in Europe? It's like, Mike, I don't think you want unrest going up in Europe. You're heavily invested in Europe. You've settled a number of issues in Europe.
Right.
With unrest, you might lose these issues later on, you know, but it wasn't immediately obvious. But like, you were kind of suggesting earlier, like, if you've got a strong military presence in Europe, you might want unrest because you'll end up claiming someone else, negotiating someone else's settled issue because you're stronger. Yeah. In Europe. And I think we're still kind of figuring out like how to leverage those mechanisms in the game, I would say, because that should inform our negotiations and
totally
get beyond just the, hey, you scratch my back now, I'll scratch your back later, or here's stretch my back for a cube. And it starts to get a little bit more sophisticated. Hopefully.
Yeah, totally. No, I totally agree. That's why I'm looking forward to like playing it more and more, you know, especially with other people who have also played it, to see how the negotiations kind of shift. But as an example, like the very first game I played of Versailles 1919 was a 4-player game, and there was an uprising. I don't remember exactly where. Let's say it was Europe, and you know, my friend who was playing, she ended up having the most Europe settled issues. So one of hers ended up becoming unsettled. And I was in a position to outbid everybody to take that issue from her. So she was kind of like upset that like she's losing 6 points. And I'm like, either way, she wasn't going to get it because she didn't like work her military. Yep. And so one of us were going to get it, not her.
Right.
And so I told her, I was like, look, I really want to do, I want to resolve this, because when you take an unsettled issue and you resolve it, you can pick whichever outcome you want, not necessarily the one who,
right,
the same thing that the original owner picked. And I was like, I really need this token because these are worth 2 points to me for each of them. And it was going to make, she was France. It was going to make France sad. And she was, so I was like, hey, I will forfeit those 2 points and I'll pick a different option if you give me something. Like, mm-hmm, you know, I would have taken even a single cube, but she was so uppity and didn't and unwilling to give me a single cube. So
right.
I was like, okay, I'm going to do the thing that's going to give me the 2 points and make France sad. And the best part about this is that at the end of the game, I didn't win, but I beat her by 2 points. By those 2 points that she could have avoided, and maybe would have gotten more if she'd just given me a cube. But it was really fun, and you know, it's exciting. Like I like that, you know, the whole balance of like when is that uprising going to happen and who's going to be impacted, you know? It definitely gives you some decision to make when you're trying to figure out what issues you want to settle, you know? Like, do I want to have the most Europe issues settled if the uprising or the unrest is pretty high in Europe? Probably not, because I might lose one, you know?
Right. So let's go over, I made a list of like things that I really like about this game. So number one, and chime in whenever you want, but
okay,
like number one, I would say I love the board. I think
yes,
this game looks great. I think the board itself is laid out like a conference table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's totally appropriate for a negotiation game in which we are negotiating over issues. And I find, like, as simple as they've made this, because as I understand it, like, this is kind of like a simpler version of Churchill.
And yes, some different.
Like,
different, but way simpler.
Yeah, yes. There's an attempt to kind of streamline some more sophisticated negotiation games. And that's kind of what Versailles is about. I find that the table and the board does a very good job of explaining, like, this is the core loop. This is what we're doing. You know,
yep,
we're going to be resolving these issues. Issues have to, like, go to the waiting room first. There will be a lot of power. And when you resolve an issue, of deciding what goes from the waiting room to the negotiating table. And so, you know, you mechanically modeling negotiation with the influence, like, the basic mechanisms are super strong. The look is super strong. So kind of like kudos to Donald Haggerty and Roger McGowan for making this game look great. And again, like the core, I think that the core mechanisms of this game are really solid, both in the issues, the way they resolve, the way they then affect things, the way they super simplified these different theaters of conflict, you know, Europe, Balkans, Middle East, you know, like it would be real easy for that to be a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
And they kept it simple, but you could still like, you know, move your army in and how much are you going to invest in your army there? And that could help suppress insurrections and other kinds of unrest so that like there is a good reflection of like, we are invested in Europe. Like we have a military and presence in Europe. We are keeping the peace in Europe. And there comes with certain costs for that, that I think this modeled really efficiently in the game.
Yeah. And we also, Trey, didn't talk about that. One of the military actions is you can demobilize your military. So that means taking your military, putting it on a space on this like demobilized track. And there's kind of whoever does it first gets the most happiness. But the first person to do it, you get 5 happiness. Next person gets 4 happiness. And, you know, you're not going to be able to deploy as many armies, but your nation is happier because you're kind of like pulling out. And when you demobilize, that army is out of the game. So the minute you demobilize one, now you only have 2, which again, the military is the core thing you use for bidding on unsettled issues to gain access to them. So
but this models the end of a war really nicely, right? Like you and you're rewarded domestically for like sending the troops home.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And like when you do that is a really interesting question. I think like, for example, your first move in the game was like, I'm going to go ahead and demobilize one of my armies and get 5 happiness. And I think later on you were questioning like, I could really have used that third.
Yes.
That third army. You know, there was a big price for that.
Right. And there were one of these strategy cards scores 2 points per army that you still have that aren't demobilized. So, you know, I should have factored in like, ooh, I might take that. And, you know, all the points matter in this game a lot.
Okay.
But yeah, I agree on the game board. Like it's very functional and the game is so simple compared to Churchill and Pericles. And it just becomes even smoother to play because of the layout, the graphic design, the layout of the board and everything makes it just really smooth.
So I think my number 3 was something we kind of already talked about here, which was what I wanted and what I got to a certain degree was the table negotiation. And I think like as you play the game more, you will be more informed about, you know, having meaningful negotiation in the game. I think the fourth thing that really worked for me was the actual history. Like this is a historical game. I thought the designers did a great job of kind of like breaking down the issues that were on the table, literally at the table at the Treaty of Versailles, and kind of looking at them and saying, here are possible outcomes of these issues that were actually negotiated in 1919, and then assigning certain effects to them. Like they would be like, this is going to make Italians unhappy. This is going to increase unrest in Europe. This is going to push back on communism. This is going to tank the German economy. You know, all of these little things, I thought, you know, this showed a lot of research, and I thought this was the best part of the game for kind of like capturing the history was the actual breakdown they did on all of the different issues with possible outcomes. And then
totally
the fifth
agree.
Thing was just that I understand that this is a very good solo game. I haven't played it solo, but from other people talking about it, supposedly this rates very highly as a solo game, maybe more so than some of these others. Have you found something different?
No, but I haven't had a chance to try it solo. I really want to, though. But, you know, of course, it's a negotiation game, so I feel like I'm probably always going to lean towards playing it with other people.
Yes.
But I am curious about the solo mode, and I've heard good things as well.
All right, any other final kind of, like, goods before I go to my criticisms of the game here?
No, I mean, I'm going to kind of just echo everything you said. Like, ever since I played this game the very first time, I loved it. You know, I love that it plays well with 3. It plays well with 4. Haven't tried it at 2 or 1 yet, so I can't speak to that. But I just think it's really interesting interaction with the players at the table. And it's just simple. And it's everything is laid out so well on the player aids. So you can really kind of teach it to anybody, you know, whether you like historical games or not.
It wasn't too hard of a teach at all.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say. Yeah, so kind of so, like, easy to teach. Yeah, you can be going and playing this game in 20, 30 minutes, you know, pretty easily, you know, which for a historical game like this, I think is impressive.
Yeah, and I would say less.
Okay. I think people still always underestimate how long it takes to teach and play games. And then they blame AP. All right, so here are my criticisms of the game. I think that the scoring system seems a little inverted. In this game, like you, when a issue gets resolved, you get 3 to 7 points, and you kind of get these points regardless of how you actually resolve it. It's just like some things are important and some things are less important, and then you kind of have these secondary effects based upon what you actually resolve. And those secondary effects are cool. I think they're like some of the coolest thing, but they also seem kind of minor compared to this is a 7-point card. And I think a lot of times people are just like, that's a 7-point card and I'm going to fight over the 7-point card. And that detracted from the, well, hey, what would be better for Italy here? Like, what are Italy's beliefs and what are the historical things that Italy wanted? It's like Italy in this case might just be like, that's a 7-point card and I have the cubes and no one else does. So I'm grabbing, you know, like that.
Yeah.
I kind of wish that they had decreased the value of just like, hey, we controlled this issue, and increased the, like, do the effects of this event actually reward your agenda in some way? That seemed off, you know, like that was that was not engaging with like the history, or not even just like the history, but like if I were advising a new player, I might just say, just try to win a bunch of issues, you know, as a starting point. Like there's a certain amount of just,
and that,
just
I mean, just that's kind of what, you know? that's never a bad idea. I see what you mean. And just to note, like there aren't that many 7-point cards. Like, I think the one that triggers the end of the game is 7 points. I think we saw like there was a reparations card that was 7, but I don't know. Most of them seem to be either 3s or 4s, and you know, some are 5s also. But I don't know, because I think they probably weighed these issues of whatever like the headline was, and by you settling the issue, meaning you had the majority of influence, it's like you're influencing the whole treaty by, you know, X amount. So I totally see what you're saying.
Right.
I just don't know if that bothers me.
Okay.
Per se. Yeah.
Fair enough. Number two issue for me was there was, again, probably shouldn't surprise people, my feelings on this. There was a little too much randomness in this game for me, just in terms of the crises and events. There are times in this game where you flip a card and that is a crisis and it will have an immediate effect. And that just, it often felt very random, and it could be kind of targeted where it's, you know, it's kind of like, hey, send all your armies home. It's like, well, I heavily invested in those damn armies. Or it can be directed of like, you know, something bad happens in Africa. And you're like, well, I'm only one who cares about Africa. And so it felt like there was a certain amount of just random slaps to the face in this game. The events themselves bothered me less because you could kind of see them coming. And then they had a mechanism where if you are settling an issue, you also have the option of placing a cube and choosing the next event, in which point you would then be the decider on it.
Of and how in it that resolves, case,
you know, that made sense to me because it's like, okay, this is a bad thing. I'm the only one in Africa. This could do a bad thing to the to Africa. And so the person who controls that now has a like, well, you can pay me to make this not happen. And like that fits into the negotiation thing. So like I was fine with that. And like, I am assuming that over time, all of that kind of stuff would even out. But I could handle that better than just the random slaps to the face that the crises did at times. But there did feel like there's plenty of times where like stuff's just happening. And it's kind of random about like how it's affecting people.
That is true. And you kind of got slapped in the face a couple that one time where you were like, hey, I'm going to purposely deploy one of my other military somewhere. Just random to get it out there in hopes to prevent a situation where a crisis came up where you would have to undeploy
send
an army home. And then instead, the next one that came up, now Trey has two militaries deployed. It was like, everybody lose a happiness per military you have deployed. So it kind of backfired to you, and it was,
maybe the idea in the game is kind of like when you play Twilight Struggle. If you're going to play that game competitively, you know all the cards. So you kind of like know what's out there. And so you kind of, if you know the cards, you know, like, oh,
you can protect,
I'm going to be putting armies out there, there's a good chance I'm going to take a couple of happiness hits over the course of the game, because that's the price of maintaining a military. Like, so maybe that's fine in the end. I don't know.
Yeah.
On Friday night, we did not finish that game. I don't think we came close to finishing that game. I do wonder if this game is too long. In my plays so far, it has overstayed its welcome a little bit.
I think it could run longer than what does the estimate say? Like about 2 hours. I think it was like 60 to 120 minutes, it says on BGG.
Yeah, that's not accurate.
But especially when you get into negotiations, you know, that kind of can, and I think new players, like, I'd be curious to see. I think you could play a game in 2 hours if everybody knows how to play. But there were some AP kind of moments.
The decisions are significant, right? Like,
but what I think you could do, and I'm actually taking a peek in the rule book right now to see if there was a, I think they have something in the rule book where if you want to play a longer game, so usually there's a game end issue card that you'll shuffle the whole issue card deck without it, deal 20, put the game end on top of the 20 cards, and then the rest of the shuffle deck on top of that. So if you really wanted a shorter game, you could just maybe add some more issues to what's below the game end to make the game end trigger come up faster. But it's going to kind of depend, because when you're picking new issues to go into the waiting room after you settle one, you could either take from the discard pile or the deck. And the deck is what's going to like push the end of the game. Mm-hmm. So if everybody's mostly taking from the discard pile, that's definitely going to like slow it down.
Right.
But I think, I don't think the length bothers me as long as it's engaging and fun the whole time. But it can run a little bit long.
We would want to play it some more, but I think I've played three games now, and two of which felt like it stayed a little longer than I would want. One suggestion that came up on Friday night was, okay, so one of my, like, I think I would actually like a little bit more history in this. And I think that's this may not be a fair criticism, because this is supposed to be the streamlined game, right? Churchill's more complicated, Pericles is more complicated, this is the streamlined game. And so I understand they have attempted to streamline this, but there does feel like, despite doing such a great job on the issues, I wish that, like, my goal as the American player or the Italian player, that aligned more with actual history. Like, those strategy cards felt pretty random and unrelated to what you actually did. So I almost like wish there were a true history mode where they just gave the strategy card to the appropriate nation, so that the British were acting more British and they were invested more in, like, the Middle East and India or whatever they were more invested in. Someone suggested that, we have these beautiful issue cards in the game, but they would have also, they have plenty of room for flavor text. It seemed like there might have been a missed opportunity for a little bit of an explanation there for players of, like, wait, why was Korea important to Japan in 1918? Right. You know, why did this did kind of lay the seeds for a lot of what happened in World War II. And so if you don't know the history pretty well, you might be like, I don't know, why am I resolving this one way or the other for Japan, whereas this actually would have been incredibly critical for Japan, the most important thing in their entire treaty, in the entire treaty for them, maybe, you know?
Right. And I think, you know, like most GMT games, in the, I think it's in the playbook, but they right. do break down, I think, every card and give you more historical context on them. But yeah, it certainly would have been, just like in Wingspan as an example, how, you know, you, whatever bird card you have, there's a little bit of text as to like, why, you know, info about the bird or some kind of fact about it. So it would have been cool. You have these nice large cards to see like a little historical blurb directly on the cards. So you don't have to just, you know, flip to the book and pass the book around. And also to know what was the true historical outtake on, you know, what, or what am I trying to say?
The historical outcome or?
The outcome. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes. The what's the true historical outcome on this particular issue? Like that would have been cool, but I would think, you know, not talking to Mark Herman and Jeff Engelstein or GMT or anybody who, you know, worked on developing this, that the reason they probably opted to just stick with the icons is literally what you were saying, to keep it streamlined and more accessible. And it's, you know, they nailed it with the accessibility, in my opinion.
Yeah, I love the issues. And, you know, kind of like wrapping it up here, like, I really like the core bones of this game. I am a fan. And so, like, despite my criticisms, like, it makes me want to play Churchill and Pericles now. Like, I want to, like, and I don't regret learning Versailles at all. Like, I really wanted to try it. I think the core mechanisms are really good. I almost wish there were, like, just another pass on it. You know, because I feel like it's just a little bit of a missed opportunity from being just from being a good game to being, like, a classic game that I would recommend without reservation.
Gotcha.
Where do you fall on that?
I fall on, I love it. I've played Churchill once before and I really love that too, but I really appreciate the, you know, how streamlined and accessible this is. I thoroughly enjoy the player interaction of, you know, bidding your influence on these different cards and getting them, and just how clean and easy it is. Like, you know, of course, after you learn the rules, but to manipulate things and strategize because of the simplicity of the actions you're taking. So I really enjoy it. Every game, even our partial game the other night, every game has been really fun. I have moments where I get like, sometimes I'm like, oh, like, why are you doing that? Don't do that. But it's good. It's what I love about playing games. It makes me feel something, you know? So I also would love to play Pericles. It's sitting on my shelf and I, started kind of learning it a while ago. So I'm down to play any more of these. The other thing, Trey, is, Triumvir is a new one, in this series that'll be out maybe next year, maybe late next year.
Okay.
And it's another, and I think they've kind of, built upon the Versailles, 1919 mechanisms and, but change some things up a bit, and that's a three-player version, but I'm hearing great things about it. So I think they take this system, so maybe that'll be something that like kind of pushes it more in a favoring direction for you.
No, I'll be eager to check that out. I'm looking at it right now. And so Triumvir would be Rome, you know, Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus during, you know, at the end of the Roman Republic. So I want to play all these games.
Yeah.
So make it happen, Candace.
All right. We're doing it.
All right. Let's transition to our member segment here. All right, Candace, you had some observations while your time this week playing games for 10 days in a row about learning games and how to be a good how to be taught a game as a player. How did this come about?
Yeah, so I guess, Trey, like, you know, I've made some observations throughout my time in the hobby, but I think the fact that I was at a 10-day convention and, you know, playing a lot of games, and when my experience at being at conventions, whenever you play a game, more often than not everybody knows how to play the game, so you're going to be someone is going to be teaching the game to other players, you know, maybe one, maybe all. But what I noticed in some cases is that, you know, certain people might be just on their phone or not paying attention. And to me, as the person, I'm not, even if I'm not the person teaching, it's distracting. I found it very distracting for me trying to learn, partially because I just feel bad for the person teaching that you have maybe someone who's being distracting and slightly rude while you're trying to teach a game. And I think it's, you know, for not everybody, of course, but I think it's hard to teach a game because it's like you want to get it right. You want to make sure people understand it. And but like so when people are not listening and paying attention in kind of a respectful way, it makes it harder on the teacher. And I think like part of the challenge is just like everybody has their own, like their different languages of love and the way people feel love from one another. I think that people teach games differently and people want to or learn games, learn games differently. You know, there's some people who like maybe want to know everything up front, and there are other people on the other side of that who are just like, just teach me the basics. I'll get into it. Cause maybe, you know, they don't care about winning. They just want to like start playing as soon as possible.
That's right.
And it's like, if you have, as a teacher, if you have kind of a mix of these people, that could be challenging. And then you also have your own teaching style and all those things sometimes don't fit together. But I think as gamers who are sitting there at the table for a teach, I think we owe it to the teacher and the other people at the table to kind of just be a little more aware and of what you're doing and how that might be impacting other people's experiences. So
I totally agree with that. I mean, like we should be this teaching a game already, like we should be grateful for that. And I am grateful when that happened. It's also very hard. Like we have devoted a number of segments on this show to how to teach a game. That said, like it is still a struggle. Like it is a skill and it's something that takes practice and it's emotionally draining. And it also like it leaves you in a vulnerable position too, because you often feel like I'm being evaluated by how well I am teaching this game. And that's before like you even get into your investment of like the way I feel about this game. And a lot of times, like I'm trying to show this game, which I'm telling you all is really good. Like the reason I'm teaching you this game is because I believe in this game and I'm trying to bring you on board on our experience. So please put down your phone and pay attention.
Yeah.
And like you're getting in the way of the other players here too. So you've got a list of things that could make you a better listener, a better person being taught a game.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things could be just being upfront with the teacher before the teach starts and tell them how you like to learn. And maybe other people at the table want to be taught the same way, and maybe they can adapt to their audience a little bit better. So that's one thing, is just kind of communicating and being upfront with like, hey, you know, I don't need to know everything up front. I like to kind of get started as soon as possible. You know, that would be helpful to me if I'm teaching a game to hear that kind of feedback from someone.
Sometimes I don't care about winning. I'm playing this game to learn. So I'm not going to sweat every detail right up front. You know, like that's important to know as a teacher. Sometimes it's like, oh, because like we certainly have those other players in our group where like if you didn't say every single rule, like that can feel like a betrayal.
Right.
That was like, you did not.
They couldn't strategize teach me this thing.
You're like, you're right, I didn't. I'm sorry. And it's like, well, what was the point of the game then?
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Be upfront with the way you like to be taught. So just people can be on the same page.
Yes, absolutely. And then I think, again, like, you know, just try to minimize distractions, like being on your phone. I know a lot of times you'll have a mixed scenario where like some players are new, maybe one played it before. So they're partially listening in, partially doing their thing on their phone. But I think again, and this is from my experience of like paying attention as the person who's being taught and also being the teacher, that can just be very distracting. And, you know, I think maybe a suggestion could be like, if you don't care about the teach, maybe just walk away from the table for 5 minutes or something, right. You know, or just pretend like you're like, but listen and watch the person, like as they're showing you stuff on the board or as they're talking to you, like give them your attention, because it's hard, you know?
I've had issues. I remember one time when I think I was like, I had played the game once and I was listening to the teach. And what I was doing was I was calling up the rules on my phone because I wanted to check a thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was doing that and I felt like the need to explain to other people is like, just so you guys know, I'm looking at the rules here. Like,
yeah, I'm not checking out.
I'm actually like looking up a specific thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's great. Like to just communicate. Like I have a friend who when he learns a game, he's very smart, but he wants to like look through all the cards and, you know, so you'll be teaching the game and he'll be just going through decks. And I've gotten to a point where it's like, all right, I know he's listening. I know he's getting this. So I just ignore it.
Right.
But I think that is another thing that like when you're being taught or when someone's teaching you the game, when you're fidgeting around on everything, that's distracting.
Well, look, so, when you're teaching, sometimes you can tell when you don't have someone's attention.
Yes.
And you're like, but at the same time, you can be like, you can stop and be like, this is a rule that new players always forget. You're going to have to feed your family. And you can't breed your animals before you feed your family. That happens after, you know, like, and you almost want to shake them. It's like, you're going to tell me I didn't explain this. I'm explaining it to you right now.
And also, like, we can help each other with this, right?
Yes.
So I taught Imperium Classics, which is a new deck building, civilization building game, to several people. The one teach I did, there was a guy playing who, you know, somebody, and it's because I'm not like, I don't care if I win or lose, especially on first games. I'm just like in there to kind of learn things, but some people care a lot.
Right.
And I, you know, that's fine. So one of the things I observed that I wasn't, when I did my teach, I should, and what I do now going forward is like, I tell everybody to look through their starting deck before they draw their starting hand and just kind of highlight some things that like, hey, here's what you have, just so you know,
sure.
Because he got to a point where a card came up and he's like, oh, I didn't even know this card kind of existed, or I would have done X, Y, my last turn differently.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, like my bad. I'll make sure I like kind of teach that way. So I think it's also really helpful to, you know, after you're listening to somebody, if maybe they didn't teach it 100% of the way that you thought it should be taught, maybe just give some suggestions to them in a friendly way for like how to teach this, or don't miss this thing later when you teach it. Like it would have been helpful to know X, Y, Z up front, you know, but in a cool, respectful, friendly way.
Right.
Because again, we're all human. We all make mistakes. Like nobody's perfect. But I think it's just the whole thing is, I think we owe it to the teachers and the other people at the table learning the game and listening to the teach to just be a little more aware and, you know, pay attention.
Yeah.
Be patient with the person who's teaching. They're probably not going to teach it like you.
Yeah. Don't have an expectation of perfection. Not going to happen. So let me tell you one thing that I've struggled with sometimes as a player. And I don't think I really know the right answer, but you kind of addressed it earlier when you're talking about the different expectations people can have as a teacher versus the expectations players can have when learning. I do know people that when they teach the game, they want players to hold all questions till the end. And I know that that is like something that I struggle with, because if I have a point of confusion on something, like the foundation of my learning house is now unstable. And like the stuff you're going to tell me after that is not going to make sense to me if I did not understand the first thing. So I sometimes question about like, is this something that can hold off to the end, or do I need to interrupt and seek clarity on this thing right now?
Yeah, I totally hear you. And I don't think it's like a black and white thing, you know. I'll give you an example. I was playing a game of Dark Ages at the convention that I went to, and the guy who was teaching it kind of just he started saying like, oh, well, this card does this and this does. And I just had no idea of what are we doing in the game.
Right.
But I just, you know, I listened, and the other person who was playing, we both just listened. And then at some point there was a pause moment, and the other guy got to it before me, but he said, hey, can we like dial it back for a minute? Like, right. What are we doing here? What, you know? And even then, even after doing that pause, it still didn't like all click with me.
Sure.
But I listened, and I just paid attention. And then, you know, so it's hard to tell when the best time to ask questions is. And I do know a couple people like that too, or like, don't ask any questions until I'm done. But
right.
But in your case, yeah, you're right. Like if there's something that's tripping you up, and now it's going to like snowball everything else into a bunch of confusion for you, you really have to bring it up. But I understand not wanting to be asked a million questions, especially when you're probably going to talk about that thing later. And that's why, you know,
it's always that. Yes, I was about to get to that.
Yeah.
And explain it, because that's the next thing. C comes after yeah. B. But yeah, it's tough. You know, it generally works out. And it is a tough balance, right? You can completely derail a teach with your questions. But I do like, yeah. There are times where I'm like, okay, I'm not getting this. I need to hit the pause button on this and roll it back. And
right,
just
right. There,
just like what's the core thing? Like, what's the core thing we're doing? Like, before we get into the details of the card.
Yeah.
You know, we're playing a card, then we're drawing a card. Okay, got it. You know, something right. Like that. Sometimes you have to understand it.
Yeah. And I often come out of teaches, and sometimes, you know, it could also be that like the people who are sitting at the table learning, like maybe they're tired and or maybe they're hungry or something. So they're mentally just distracted. And I feel like I might have some of that going on. Or also I just think I'm a slower learner because sometimes I'm not following, like I'll listen to what somebody's saying. I feel like I'm paying attention, but then I'm just not grasping like, what does my turn even look like? And sometimes it might be partially my fault, or it could be partially the teacher didn't really explain it, and that's how I need to learn, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm not someone who is like, oh, I'm gonna be so mad if I don't win. You know, I don't care. So to me, if we just get started and then I ask questions and kind of like figure it out as I go. This happened with Civilization and New Dawn with the expansion. I kind of came out of the teach very fuzzy on what I was going to be doing. And then that's when I started really liking it as I understood
sure,
how the
right.
game worked. And I'm like, oh, I see.
Learning
and of
game,
course,
learning
by,
game.
right. And of course, by then it was probably too late for me to have some grand master strategy, but it's a learning game. It's my first time playing. I'm not going to like be trying
yeah,
to
it's
like
not, it's
rule.
Not reasonable to come out of the teach feeling like, oh, I understand this game. Like that's impossible. And it's also like, it would have to be almost like over-explained.
Right.
But for that to happen. I'd say especially after this weekend, and maybe this was what you're experiencing too, especially over 10 days of gaming, is I have a much healthier respect for how much energy is required to learn a new game.
Mm.
You know,
when
you go to a convention, and especially like you go to BGG Con, and like you're playing three or four new games a day, maybe more, you know, like,
right.
You know, depending on their length, but you're jamming them in, and it's like, and that's incredible. That takes up a tremendous amount of energy. And yeah. I find my batteries, as I've gotten older, my batteries get tapped a lot quicker. And like that can be, gotcha. There's sometimes where I recognize it's like, okay, I'm running on low here. This is going to be a tougher teach. And so like, that's actually like time to get your learning hygiene even more in place. Right. You know,
right.
Where you need to focus more, be more respectful, and maybe even slow it down because I think I'm actually like actively curating my own experience at these conventions more now, where once I've learned two games in a day, I'm ready for a game I already know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we've all been there, like, I'm not up for another teach. Like even right. if it's a game I really want to do, especially if it's a game I really want to do, like I want it to be really special. And if I'm already really taxed, because learning games takes a tremendous amount of energy. It's exhausting.
Or Trey, what you could do is like me, when I flew in for this convention that I went to, I took a red eye, so I didn't sleep. And then I got, you know, I started playing games around noon by the time I got like settled in the hotel and did some work. And then I was playing all night, and I think it was like 11 o'clock at night at that point that I started playing a game of Oath, which I had played before, but like barely remembered. It was like 6 months ago on TTS. So I had someone teaching it, and I was just like not, you know, very fuzzy.
Did you tap out?
At that point, I had learned a lot. Well, no, I didn't really tap out, but, you know, it's just brain was slowing down. But what we did was we were just like afterwards, we're like, let's play it again. So we just played back-to-back games. And then by the time we played it the second time.
To double down? Okay.
Yes, yes.
Well, there is something to that, too, is the, you know, because we have like, it's just learning game.
Yeah.
I do find a lot of times, especially, you know, people are struggling with the teach, but then they get into the game, they finally are understanding the game 2/3 of the way through. And then a lot of times people are like, okay, now we're ready for a real game. And yeah. that can be a struggle sometimes, even just socially, to say, okay, now let's play that again.
Right.
Like we had that a little bit at BrainCon this weekend where our friend Mark came into town. We played Panamax with him. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, like Ben really loves Panamax. I really love Panamax. We wanted to get Paul to play. And, but, you know, Mark had struggled to learn the game the first time, but came out of it really liking it and said, I'm ready to play that game again. Let's put it back up on the board. And we tried to get it back on the table and kind of couldn't because it was going to require another teach for somebody. But that is like a lot. Like, I always feel like that's a good sign of like you finish it and you kind of want to play it again. I think
one of
the big things we're always wrestling with is, you know, when I really like a game, I am like then ready to play it like 20 times.
Yeah.
And I think there's other people that are like, I'm new. I want to try the new thing. When I really like something, like I really am ready to play Panamax about 20 times now. Even though it's an old, you know, it's 4 or 5 years old now or more. Gosh, who knows? But still, like, I'd like to go deep on certain things.
And that's another thing kind of going back to like learning games is, you know, maybe your style is, hey, let's just set it up. Start playing a couple turns, talk through it, and then like agree that after a couple turns, we all see how it works. We reset and, you know, start it again. Cause then everybody has like pushed some cubes around or whatever, played some cards and gets a better feel for it. And I guess that's also like maybe just a different approach to teaching, but it depends on how your audience likes to learn. But I've had many moments like that where we've kind of started playing and it clicks midway or, you know, after a round and it's like, let's just reset it and start again.
I think that's great.
And, because and sometimes we do. Yeah.
It helps reinforce that like this really wasn't about winning anyway.
Right.
Like, sometimes it's important to do, like we did this with Versailles on Friday night where we like, we decided like it was getting later. We decided to cut it off, but it's like, let's do a scoring at the end. So everyone understands, like, this is where we're going to end up. So you understand, like, what's the finish line like when you get there? Just we're going to go a lot further when we play it. All right, great. Well, are you up for a game sommelier?
Sure.
Sometimes a player just got to know which game should stay, which game should go, which to play with maman, madame, abou. You got to tell me, monsieur, just what to do. Want to make an impression, but I can't get far. As my 50th play of Agricola, a million games, show me the way to the master, the game sommelier.
All right, so Ekis Giannini writes, what's a Euro with A, a great map-based board, and B, natural-seeming victory conditions? By natural-seeming victory conditions, I mean something other than victory points or point salad-type points. Obviously, it's easy for a war game to have natural victory conditions like territorial domination or player elimination, but I'm attracted to Euro-style game mechanics while being unattracted to Euro-style point accumulation. So points or even VP targets feel like a design cheat to me or a fudge anyway. To make it even harder, I find secret objective card solutions as found in lots of games, for example, Ticket to Ride, a little unsatisfying. So any ideas, all suggestions welcome, but especially wonderful if it's a game with a strong spatial component, being map-based or otherwise strongly visual. So, Candace, map, a game with a strong map element, but maybe not victory points. Thoughts?
I think maybe something that comes to mind, I've already talked about on today's episode, but Civilization, A New Dawn. And if you haven't tried it, I recommend playing with the expansion that came out, I think, last year.
Now, is that a modular map? I still haven't played that game. It's a modular map, right? It's
not like a modular map.
Yeah.
Right. It's a modular map, and you can kind of explore and put out new tiles. But the victory condition is... you have kind of like maybe one game you're trying to get a certain amount of, you have to complete a certain amount of public objectives. And the first person to do it, I think it's four, the first person to do it wins the game. Mm. So it's sort of a race to achieve these goals, which could be building wonders, could be different types of wonders, could be having a fortress, having control of a certain amount of fortresses, stuff like that. That's a good one. The Oracle of Delphi, another one that I played recently, has a modular map setup. It's kind of water-based, but right. There are different islands that are out there, and you are competing to complete objectives for Zeus before your opponents. So it's, there are no victory points, but everybody has these like 12, I think it's 12 objectives that you're trying to do, and you're racing to complete them. And then another one I could think of, Trey, that I think, although I don't know if it falls in a Euro category per se, but Oath, Cole Worley's latest game. In Oath, you have like one player who's the chancellor and the other players are exiles and can become citizens. But the whoever starts as the chancellor, you get one of these... there's like oath tokens, I think, that says like, here's the goal of the game for you,
how you win the game depends upon the session. There's about four different ways in each game, and then it'll change. Yeah. Like, what's the primary way you win the next time you play? So like, Oath is a good one for this, where it's kind of like, it's good, but it's also a little bit like wrong, because like Oath doesn't have a map per se. It has a conceptual map, which I think is fascinating, right? Because there's like the inner, what do they call it? It's not inner sphere, outer sphere, but you have like, you have a homeland, and then you have the hinterland. What is it? How does it actually break it down?
I don't remember, but I guess, you could just kind of think of it as like these different zoned areas, and you can move between them, and they each have like their own kind of decks of cards and areas that you can discover.
The way to think of them is almost like distance from the capital. There's like the capital, which is this turn is going to be, the giant's land. And then there's going to be the ones that are nearby. And then there's going to be the ones that are on the edge of the world, but we're still playing with. And one of the really cool things about that game is, based upon the results of the previous one, like one of those lands that was way out there in this session is now the capital.
Right.
Next time. And so like the geography of your map, your abstract geography just changed, which I think that's one of the things I think is really cool about Oath.
It's really fascinating. And like, again, from the victory points, it's like, if today's game, maybe you care about ruling as many regions as possible, but tomorrow's game might be like, I want to get as many books as I can,
Right. But you're going to hit that victory condition, and then certain players are going to be the winner. It's not like first is Candace with 13 points. Second is Trey with 8.
Right.
That's not how Oath works at all. I had taken this as, just thinking of like pretty maps, like what are some great map games that aren't just victory point. That aren't resolved with victory points. I really like the old Dune board game that has the map of Arrakis as a big circle, and that's going to be determined by controlling, these important population centers, and when you whether you can do it by yourself or you have to form an alliance, like that seems to meet the question here. I do prefer the older game to the new redo. It's just in terms of the art, I still think the old one was better. I still really love the Indonesia map for Splatter.
Oh, yeah.
The text they use is a little flowery and hard to read, but like that's a really cool map where you actually like sometimes there are pleasures in some of the older style games like Risk, where like part of your mastery of the game is looking at the board and understanding what the important positions to hold are in the game. Like there's some knowledge to be learned by like putting your elbows on the table and studying the map. And I think there's some of that in Indonesia that can be pleasurable. I think there's some of that in like a game like Friedrich, which is another kind of map game.
Oh yeah.
Where like at first it seems like a chaotic jumble of routes and intersections. But I think like once you've played the game a couple of times, you realize, oh, there's a few key choke points here where you can kind of like stage your massive defense. You know, this is like, you know, there's a few places you should be considering to really make your stand in the game. But like Friedrich's like you've played that, right? And I just
played it recently with Ben actually and a couple other people for the first time. And I loved it, except that I ended up being Friedrich for the first game because we randomly drew. And I'm like, oh no,
that's a lot. That's a lot to take on.
It was so stressful, but I was like, this is a growing opportunity for me. It was out of my comfort zone, but I did the best I could.
Yeah, I was going to mention like the pandemic games always seem to have like a map element that's important. Yeah. But those are going to be, you know, those are going to be cooperative. And then like the final one I think I wanted to mention was I just remember really loving the map of A Few Acres of Snow. Another, you know, Martin Wallace game, one of the first deck builders. Deck builders, that's a historical game there. And like that has some end game conditions that are like knockout conditions. If one side or the other can kind of like take over a certain space, then that's an instant win in those games, as opposed to it going to something like victory points in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I love A Few Acres of Snow, but I want to mention another one. It's called Hand in the Sea or Hands in the Sea. Mm-hmm. That was kind of built upon the system that Martin Wallace designed in or developed with A Few Acres of Snow. And I think it's more of like a Spartan Athens kind of
Punic Wars, struggle. Romans and the Carthaginians.
Yeah, but again, it's map. It has deck like interesting deck building. And I haven't played it yet, but I just got it a couple weeks ago. I'm really excited.
Yes, I'm looking. It looks like a very pretty map of Italy, Sicily, and Carthage across the Mediterranean there. So. Good recommendation. Well, Candace, this has been great. This is our first episode together.
Yeah.
I look forward to many, many more.
Same here, Trey.
I think we ended up with a number of lists of games that you said we really need to get together and play together. So I'm going to hold you to it because
yes.
I think you are the historical gamer along with me here. Like I may not be a war gamer, but I do want to play the historical games. And so I need to grab you more often so we can play more of these
games.
I'm
down. We'll do it.
Great.
Churchill and Pericles.
You have been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson, Tom Donnelly, and Trey Alsop. Thanks to Edamaros Pelig for our art, and thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. You know them as Alfred. More on Daedalus at gamebrainpod.com. You can reach us by email at contact@gamebrainpod.com or on Twitter at gamebrain_pod. Thanks for listening, and go play some games with friends. Or go make some friends with games. Thanks, Candace.
Thanks, Trey.